Not to bum you out or anything, but the weekend's over. It's Monday now, and here we are. Good morning. Welcome, everybody. It is a it's a very nice, it's actually a beautiful day, a lovely, lovely day out. Hopefully it is where you are as well. We welcome you on this Monday, the 28th of April, to the Roundtable panel, and we'll be talking about issues of great importance to our world at large, and we welcome your input. We have wonderful panelists to discuss these issues as well, and I want to introduce them to you right now. Sandra Freeman Tolbert joins us, partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hannah. Good morning, Sienna. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you.
It's really good to have you here. Thank you very much. Trio of microphones. Very nice. We welcome Mark Whitman, investment banker on Wall Street. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. I spent my weekend at a hockey tournament, my son's hockey tournament, if I need to specify. I could write an interesting cultural essay about a lot that happened in New Jersey, but I
just in general, having nothing to do with the hockey tournament.
Yeah, well, both. But I will say it's a privilege, it's a blessing to be able to spend time with your child, see them pursue an activity that they really enjoy, and see them get just a little bit better and have a good time with their mates. It was fun.
Well, that's great. Well, very, very nice. I'm glad you had a good time. That's cool. Do they have to go to New Jersey, though? Can you play hockey in Poughkeepsie? Like, what?
Well, the good news, Joe, is that there's an Empire tournament up here next weekend. Now, we actually won't be participating in that, but they have them all over, even in the spring. It's 80 degrees outside, but you still need a coat for that rink.
Yeah, you do. Well, that's great. Well, good on you for being a good travel parent. That's do you do that too? Are you travel around?
Yes, I do. My son had his first track meet, which I found to be terrible. I mean, it's watching kids walk around from event to event. I was watching him with his friends go from event, and then he ran like one race, and then I was like, okay, but I have to stay throughout. The obligation. So
that's right.
I just have questions about track meets. I need more information. It was my first one, so don't judge me.
Well,
no, no judging on the round table.
No, not at all.
On Saturday night, we all saddled up, got dressed, got to the rink, and we realized it's hard to play without ice.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
So all of these activities have their foibles.
I used to go with my nieces and nephews as they traveled around, and there was this one parent. It was just amazing to me. We would go maybe, I would say, 20 events, and it always started the same. Dinner in the evening always started the same way. I'm sorry, I don't think we've ever met. Yeah, we have, actually. We spent about 4 hours sitting out in a field. Yeah, we've met. And it was just every single solitary time. I don't believe we've met. I'm glad I made an impression.
Parent protocol is you reintroduce yourself.
Yes. Oh, well, I know I'm just the uncle, but still. Jim Ketterer is here. He is a senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. This weekend, I went to a concert at Universal Preservation Hall, and I saw a band from Mali, Via Farca Torre. And I heard about this concert because I was listening to the roundtable, and they were playing music from that and announced it. And so it's a reminder to everybody to make sure you not just listen to us and hang on every word, but listen to the music. And when some of the events are announced, you might get up and get out and go to them and support live music in the area.
Is there, we are blessed with fantastic venues, but UPH, Universal Preservation Hall in Saratoga Springs, is one of the most glorious, gorgeous event spaces I've encountered.
It is. I grew up in Saratoga, so I remember when that was a church.
Yes.
And then I think it was vacant for a long time.
A long, long time.
And
under really bad condition.
They've done great work and great programming. We have so many great venues in the area.
Absolutely.
And it's also was great to see so many people there and enjoying music from a very famous person playing African music, and it was just a great feel-good event.
Well, very good. All right, now that everybody feels good, we'll take care of that. Let's get on to the news of the day. I just want to make mention before we do that, on Wednesday, this program will be broadcasting from Oneonta, New York. We will be in Oneonta bringing WAMC on the road, and we will be presenting this program at Hartwick College in Oneonta, and it's 100 days of the Trump administration. We have a group of 8 government students from Hartwick College who, with Laurel Elder, and who is a regular on this program, and 2 other co-directors of that incredible institute, will be with us, and we'll be talking about all kinds of things. We have had interactions with their students in the past who've been on the program, and they're just amazing. And these kids, I was reading up on some of these kids who've been traveling all over the world over the last 2 or 3 years and have come back with these amazing stories and perspectives as a result of their traveling the globe, and will be presenting a lot of this to us on the program on Wednesday. We open the doors at 8:30. The show starts at 9. We'll go from 9 to 10:30 at Shinneman Chapel Hall in on the campus of Oneonta, of Hartwick in Oneonta. If you'd like to join us, you certainly can. All you have to do is go to WAMC.org, WAMC.org. Just click on the link, and tickets are $50, and all the money goes to WAMC. And as you may have heard, we need it. And so it's a great day, and we're very excited about that event.
You know, Joe, I just want to say that I think it's great that you're having that event and it's involving students, and you also have students who are regularly on the round table. I just get so annoyed over and over again when I hear people talk about kids today and they're complaining about what kids don't know, and it's just dead wrong. It's absolutely wrong. And 9 times out of 10, if not more, when people are saying that, they've had no experience in dealing with young people. And so I'm so glad that you're doing this.
I have to say, and this is no disrespect to you as a group, you all are wonderful, but I so enjoy being with the kids. I mean, it's so much fun.
And it's important.
And they're really great. And they have so much to say, and they're really thoughtful. I'll just, a quick anecdote, and then I promise I'll get to the show. But we, a couple shows ago, we had a young man on, and he was like, he was fantastic. I mean, I would have voted for him. Like, I mean, he was just fantastic. You know, he had all these great ideas and all that. And when he left, I was like, my God, this guy's a star. And the professor afterwards wrote to me and said, it was so interesting to me because they never talk in class. And I thought, oh, that's so fascinating. And then, like, you open this up into this environment and they just let it go. And I thought that was so cool. Now, I wish they'd speak out in class, too, but that's fine. I mean, I just think it was really neat. Obviously, they're taking a lot of stuff in, and it was really, really neat. And so this is a wonderful opportunity that we have. I think we have 8 students, I believe, that are taking part. We're going to be doing them in 2 groups, and we're really excited. So it'll be a good show. WAMC.org, just click on the link, and you can find out how you can be a part of our program in Oneonta on Wednesday morning. All right, let's go to the stories of the day. I thought we'd begin with the one that really has just stayed at obviously, 100 days is coming up, so the presidential approval ratings are out. There are 2 major ones, one from the New York Times, one from the Washington Post. New York Times is with Siena. I believe the Washington Post ABC Ipsos poll is the other one. 2 major polls. They're essentially the same, basically the same thing, that the Trump approval rating has gone very low as Americans criticize his major policies. And this comes after very high expectations. I think one of the things that was interesting in the poll, as far as the pollsters go, is that they felt that what you saw was this ratings decline that was so quick within, yes, just 100 days. And usually it's more gradual. And in this point, it was, and you also get that honeymoon period at the beginning where you start and then the ratings will tend to go up where that was it was sort of holding steady and then just went down. Anywhere from 39% to 42%, given the various polls of the approval rating for our president of the United States. One thing, this I believe was in the Siena poll, but the one number that struck me is that 66% of those who responded said that they found this administration to be scary. And even people who approved of Donald Trump said that it was scary. And I thought that was maybe not the word that you want used to describe your first 100 days, but maybe it is. I don't know. Maybe that's the intention, too. So real quick, I'll read this from the Washington Post, and then we can get started as to what we make of such numbers and what they mean, if anything. As he nears the end of his first 100 days in office, President Donald Trump is facing growing opposition to his ambitious and controversial agenda, with his approval rating in decline, majority opposition to major initiatives, and perceptions that his administration is seeking to avoid complying with federal court orders. No president in modern times has moved more swiftly than Trump to remake so many parts of government as well as some outside institutions. The moves range from shrinking and reshaping the executive branch to upending the global economic order to cracking down on illegal immigration to challenging leading universities in our country. The initiatives have caused significant disruption to individuals, institutions, and financial markets. They have produced a flurry of lawsuits from opponents, which Trump is contesting. There are few bright spots in the survey for the president, and none of his policies tested in the poll enjoy a majority of support. Trump's overall approval rating is lower than it was only 2 months ago. The Washington Post ABC Ipsos poll shows that 39% of adult Americans approve of the way Trump is handling his job, compared with 55% who disapprove, including 44% who disapprove strongly. In February, those numbers were 45% positive, 53% negative. Sienna, we'll start with you.
I mean, fear is the, in my practice, fear is the exact adjective that I would use to describe how people feel right now. I mean, I was shocked a couple weeks ago when my own spouse was concerned about us coming back over the border from Canada to the U.S. I said, not you too. I was like, no, not. I've never seen so many calls, telephone calls from U.S. citizens who are concerned about what happens if they travel internationally, what happens when they go to the through the airport, what's going on with their mobile device being searched, what are their rights, what's happening there. And now on the horizon, I'm sure I'm going to get more calls because May 7th is the real ID. So now we're dealing with domestic travel, right? And what kind of identification you need to have then when you travel domestically. So with all these things going on, of course, fear is the answer. And of course, the approval ratings would reflect that, because that's what's happening in our, you know, that's what the tenor is in the country right now. Everyone wants to know what's their constitutional rights. I've never had so many constitutional conversations. And everyone's afraid of the power of the court to uphold their constitutional rights. Everyone's watching that. So I think all of these things coupled with what's going on in the courts, and I think it all leads to these approval ratings reflecting what they are and people being fearful, even U.S. citizens. And I think that's what's new to me in this administration.
Mark Whitman.
You know, Sienna, maybe we can circle back to that, because I do have friends, U.S. citizens, who are afraid to travel abroad. Mm-hmm. And if they are thinking about it, they're also thinking about what they need to do with their devices when they come over the border. When I thought about this, I looked about at this a little differently. If you think about, I'm actually buoyed by this in a couple of ways, not so much legislatively in the short term. I think Republicans, if you think about the salient concerns for most Republicans, particularly those in the House, it's about being primaried on the right. So I don't think Donald Trump's diminishing star is something that they're going to respond to until after the midterms, because frankly, you got to win the primary in order to be up for election. Donald Trump himself despite what he may muse about, does not have to face the voters again. And frankly, even if he gets a third term, it probably won't be because of the voters. And he seems to like spectacle even more than popularity, because for him, spectacle has always led to popularity. So I don't think this chastens him all that much. I do think with respect to the courts, I think this does increase the odds that the Supreme Court is willing to stand in front of Trump and be more of an impediment than he would have otherwise. And I think about a switch in time saves nine. And even the Warren Court in Brown versus Board of Education, if you read their decision, right, they said that the states had to pursue desegregation with deliberate speed. They used this term that allowed them some wiggle room. It sounds almost like, if you think about it, the Garcia decision,
exactly.
Right? And so I think as Donald Trump's star dims, the court will find itself more political room, hopefully, to stand in front of him. I think for the Democrats, you know, the unfortunate news in this poll is that the Democrats poll still well below the Republicans and just ahead of an unmitigated disaster. I mean, I think the issue is that this is a general poll, and once it becomes a salient decision in the midterms, I think American voters, even in this partisan world, will find themselves able to switch parties in order to defend what they think are their own interests. And this president was elected because he was not only going to stop inflation, but he literally was going to bring prices down. And he's actually done the opposite. And I think more and more voters are realizing that they got duped.
Jim Ketter. Actually, Jim, so we have about a minute and a half, but I'll let you start and then we'll break and then you can come back and finish. Does that sound okay?
That sounds very good. Well, I agree with Mark. I don't think this chastens Donald Trump at all. I think that he not only spectacle, but he is very happy to be sowing fear, chaos, lawlessness. This is what he ran on. This is what he's doing. And I think to kind of consider what the implications are for November 2026 and the midterm elections is assuming that we're living in normal times and we're going to have normal politics and those dynamics matter. And I'm not sure that they do. I think we are in the midst of an immediate, urgent emergency. And Senator Chris Murphy keeps saying this. Ezra Klein is talking about it. Many others. And I don't think we have a time to consider the implications for maybe the Democrats can find their footing and something can happen and retake the House. I think that irrespective of these numbers, Donald Trump will continue to sow lots of damage in the meantime.
We'll hold there and we'll come back and talk more about this upon our return. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'd love to have you and your thoughts with us. Panel at WAMC.org. First, we're going to take a news break from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us on this Monday morning. It is the 28th of April. We have been talking about the approval rating of President Trump as we come closer to his first 100 days in office of his second term. And two major polls, one from the Washington Post, one from the New York Times, that we have been talking about. In the Washington Post coverage, for all the negative findings related to the president's actions, the poll offers little comfort for Democrats. Americans trust Trump over congressional Democrats by 37% to 30% when it comes to dealing with the country's major problems. Another 30% trust neither and see the Democratic Party as somewhat more out of touch with the concerns of most people than either the president or the Republican Party. Well, that's not good news for the Democrats, is it?
No, it's certainly not. It seems like the Democrats are still in a long, long period of circular firing squad. And, you know, I think the fallout from the 2024 results goes on and on, but really struggling to find their footing.
I actually don't look at it that dimly. It's not unusual in our political system for the party that loses the presidency to lack a leader. Just by the we're not a parliamentary system where there always is an official leader of the other party. The Democrats for a while benefited from Nancy Pelosi's effectiveness, and she sort of filled that gap to some extent. But the voters are going to make a decision in 2 years between candidate Democratic and Republican candidates on a local basis, and that's going to crystallize the decision. And I think given these popularity ratings and what the president is up to versus what he promised he is in his administration, I think it's pretty clear that Democrats will fare well. What happens in the interim, I'm a little bit on the James Carville side of the spectrum. I think a lot of the action in terms of standing in front of the administration is going to be in the courts. I'm not sure without a supermajority what the Democrats could do at this juncture. Anyway, if you think about what Donald Trump is doing, he's unusual in a president in his first 100 days in that he doesn't have a major piece of legislation that he's trying to push through. Look back at Obama, at Clinton, even at Biden, right? Trump's got his tax cuts for the rich, but that's about all he's up to legislatively. So I get that the Democrats feel like they're in the wilderness. I don't think that's historically that unusual. And I think they'll feel a lot less so if trends continue and they put up a reasonable slate of candidates.
So part of the Carville argument was is that you stay quiet and you stay low and you let them kind of kill themselves.
Yeah, I think also unspoken in Carville, I'm reading between the lines, but I think there was a little bit of we don't need some of the cringe moments, like standing in front of USAID and singing protest songs, because that really, or look, if you want to do an interpretive protest dance, that's okay, but let's not depend on that for a really strong political statement. I think artistic expressions like that are fine, but I don't think we should, and they may well serve a purpose for many personally and in a communal sense, but I don't think we should expect them to turn the tide of politics.
Well, you know, I'm sorry. I just think that's a great point, though, because I do believe, because so many people are saying, what can we do? 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 I hear it all the time. And I was speaking to a woman at a cocktail reception the other night, and she said, there weren't really cocktails, but that's another story. It was beer and wine. It was fine. But the woman said to me, you know, I've been going out every week, and I'm doing these hands-off protests. I don't know if they do any good or not. And I said, well, if they do good for you, right? I mean, if you're feeling helpless, and this is something that gives you a purpose and something that helps you be with other people who are feeling like you are, that seems like that is okay. So I understand your point. It may not change the political will of the United States of America, but we also do need just coping mechanism. And if that includes an interpretive dance, then so be it.
I was going to say I completely agree with you that this is all about the court versus judicial branch versus the executive branch right now. That's what you're really seeing happen. That's where the weird power struggle is. But we do need someone to kind of like look to a little bit. I think that everyone's looking for that person, right? We were looking at Newsom for a little bit, but then like, oh my gosh, this past weekend was Buttigieg. He was doing an excellent job on I forget what podcast he went on, but it was a lot of chatter about that. And so everyone's kind of looking for someone to follow. AOC's out there. And so they want someone to hold on to and to like give them that hope.
But I think
this is an important part of getting through the day to day of when dealing with what's happening right now is you need someone that's going to stand up against what's happening right now. They want a face for that. That's what the people want right now. People are frustrated.
Oh, I agree. I think there's a marketplace of candidates and ideas. But I think this is normal. I think normally you spend the 2 years before the midterms in that world where you're searching for someone, and all sorts of people may find different answers. Those people then crystallize into the darlings who show up in the primaries over the next 2 years, and then you coalesce at the time that there's at the presidential election.
I have to disagree. I don't think what's going on right now is normal. I think it's not like George W. Bush is president and people don't like that and they're going to run against it, or, you know, it's one party versus another. It's a marketplace of ideas and differing policies. I think we have an immediate challenge to our democratic system and our constitutional order. We have a president who has demonstrated already over and over and over again that he is not going to abide by judicial orders. We have him, you know, saying that he's not going to abide by elements of the Constitution, including the prohibition to run again. We have him threatening allies. On and on and on. This is not normal politics, not a normal timeline. And to the point of, you know, people protesting, you know, if that can help mobilize people, keep them mobilized, and then translate into actually turning out to the polls and voting. The name of the game in presidential elections now is not so much swing voters, but it's mobilizing your base, keeping them mobilized, and getting them to the polls. And the Democrats did not do that in 2024 with their own base. And so that's, I think, the value of protests. I do anticipate that as the weather gets warmer across the country, I hope, there will be more protests, but I wouldn't be surprised to see the administration also use force against protests. I think we're in for a hot, very difficult summer. So these are not normal times. In terms of a voice, you know, in Obama kind of came out of nowhere. You know, he was a state senator. Then he became a U.S. senator in kind of a quirky election in Illinois. And he was only a U.S. senator for 2 years. And so I think the voice could come from lots of different places and not be some of the leading contenders already.
But there is a sense of urgency. I think there, like you said, there is a sense of urgency. People need it yesterday.
Right.
Yeah. Yesterday they need someone.
November 2026 is a light year away.
To me, that's where the Democrats are failing. There's not this, they're not galvanizing enough, fast enough to say, like, this is the person or what we're doing. It feels like we're out there on our own.
So
I think that's what everyone feels like. They're out there doing their own thing in every different little pocket, and there's a huge thing happening.
Okay, look, we have to stand. I agree. When I said normal, I meant the process for the Democrats to coalesce
around. Yeah, I'm not
around.
Being critical of you, Mark.
But I'm not saying this is a normal administration. But let's say tomorrow the Democrats found their savior. So what? What do they do?
Right.
Then what?
Yeah.
This is the court's battle for the next. We got to hold on tight. I mean, I'm sure there's some sort of subversive resistance within the administrative branch. I mean, certainly the sidecar, I'll call them the sidecar organizations like the Fed, right, have to batten down the hatches and hold themselves in their keeps. And the courts have to defend the rest. But even if we all decided that Governor Newsom was, you know, he was the man, or pick your woman, I don't care, or they pick any person, it's still the battle lines don't change for the next 2 years.
But you still need a voice, right? Like, you know, like throughout history, there's always, you know, there's this dictator, there's this opposing party, there's this opposing voice that people can unify behind. I feel like there needs to be something that individuals can unify behind and support. Right now, we're all over the place. We're scattered.
And use that voice effectively.
Effectively. Even if it's just
one thing
going
that Trump
news,
does, you have to give him credit. He is extremely
Trump
effective.
Would love that. He would love to have
being able to use that voice.
So let's say we had a voice. I mean, I don't mean to be a provocateur here, but let's say we had one voice.
One voice.
So what? This is still being decided sort of agency by agency, court case by court case in the meantime.
And that's the scary thing here.
But what's the alternative? If we had a voice,
I'm not
what's
saying
the
there's
alternative?
An alternative, but okay. I'm saying that the situation is such that the people in power now, doesn't matter what their polling numbers are, they are in place, and short of some unimaginable kind of event, they are going to stay in place, and they are going to wreak absolute havoc in our government for at least the next year and a half, unendingly.
I have a dim view of this. Unfortunately, this is a Shakespearean tragedy. We are late in Act Two. There will inherently be carnage, death, and destruction before we get to the end of this. We've set that path. Now that we've bought the ticket and the electorate decided to sit in those seats, I don't think there's much we can do about it, certainly in a legislative sense.
Carnage, death, and destruction. It's only 9:45 a.m. Monday morning.
Good morning, everybody.
Exactly.
You know, Mark, I understand, and I agree with you to some extent. I do think that however, that and maybe I'm misreading the comments of of both Sienna and Jim, but I don't think so. But I find it, I think we need a chorus of voices. I mean, there's so much going on, but what, like, where is the opposition? Within the people who we have voted for within the House, within the Senate, within leadership, why are they not screaming at the top of their lungs? And I don't, okay, I don't know whether it does any good or not. It probably doesn't. But my God, you know, you just turn over and sit, and as you say, you've got your ticket to the
tragedy,
and you're just sitting in the, you know, sitting in the back row, waiting so you can skip out and buy some gum. I don't know. It just seems to me that somebody should be up screaming and yelling.
Yeah, look, if you know, if leering it into the wind like Bernie Sanders makes you feel better while the acts unfold, then so be it. You're not going to change the outcome in the meantime. And I'm happy to be wrong. I mean, listen, if I thought what we were playing for is we find the opposition leader and we can dramatically change our lot in the interim, I would be all about that project. But I'm not, because I'm not. No one's told me, well, here's what happens.
And that's the problem. And yeah, that's what we're saying is the problem, right? We're saying, like, it's always the Democrats' problem is that the huge big tent, everyone's doing something in different little pockets against this. We have the lawsuits from the AGs. Then we have AOC and Bernie. And then we have Newsom with his podcast. Then we have Buttigieg on the road doing his podcast and doing his podcast interviews. We have all these different pockets. We're all like, where do we look? What do we do? And we all know what's going on is wrong. So how do we push all that together? And that's what we're saying.
I think
pie
we take
in the sky, but we need that.
I think we take comfort from the fact that there are a number of numerous and more everyday resistance cells popping up in terms of court cases, in terms of the agencies that are standing up against, like the Fed, for instance, up against them. And we realize that we are not going to open up a massive front. This is a rebel effort in the meantime, frankly.
I think you have just such a and we'll have to go to a break on this, but you have such a razor-thin margin in both the House and the Senate. I mean, there is a realism here that you could work on talking to. You don't think so?
I disagree. I think you need a supermajority in order to change things. I do think there are things at the margin that the legislators should be doing. And when we get to, for instance, trade policy, if you remember during FDR's administration, it was during his administration that they put in the constitutional amendment that you can only serve two terms as president. And they kind of said, this sucks, we're not going to insult this guy, but let's make sure this never happens again. For instance, on trade policy and on the use of national emergencies, yep, we should be working on legislation that says, hey, we're happy to skip Trump, and since we don't know who the next president is, let's all agree this sucks and we ought not ever do this again. And I do think that the Democrats start to push that, they may get enough Republicans that it also then starts to cast a bit of a shadow on the current administration. So I do think there are things at the margin you can do, but I think it's very limited without a supermajority.
But, you know, I think that the current situation is also a stark reminder to all of us that the guardrails that have been in place have largely not been statute or institutional. It's all of the other things in the American experiment that have kept presidents and other leaders from violating those guardrails. And so if there's no adherence to the norms, it's not just going to be Congress that has to deal with it. I mean, I think a lot of the battleground we already see is in the states, in this federal system, but also all the other kinds of major institutions, the big law firms, some of which have knuckled under, the universities, which are trying to figure out what to do. Some are going to fight back, some are not, some are scared, and they're saying that they're scared. And all of the other aspects of civil society, that's going to be, and I think Mark was saying this, that's going to be where the resistance to this madness comes from.
And then on the eighth day, WAMC listeners took to their keyboards and wrote lots and lots and lots of letters. And we will go to those upon our return after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable 951 on this Monday morning, the 28th of April. And Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Jim Ketterer, and Mark Whitman make up the panel. We include you in the conversation as well through your letters. We welcome them at panel at WAMC.org. We have quite a few. We'll get to as many as we can before the top of the hour. Ricky writes, President Trump expects his plan to bring back manufacturing to the U.S. using tariffs to accomplish it will cause the American public some short-term pain in exchange for long-term gain. He stated that a recession is possible. President Trump is probably not too surprised or concerned about his low approval ratings. We do know that normally the president is very keen on knowing his numbers, and when they are good, obviously is quite pleased with them. Jeff says—
Can I just say about that letter? I'm not sure if the letter writer is supporting the underpinnings of that policy.
I don't think so.
Or not, but you know, it just every economist across the political spectrum has weighed in on this and said that that's just not workable. It's not how it's going to work. It could well bring on a recession, but not the return of manufacturing to the country.
Here's a letter for you, Mark. It's not to you, but I want to ask you about it. Mary says, Democrats' poor showing in polls may be due to poor press coverage of actions such as Booker's and Jeffrey's Capitol Steps sit-in yesterday, which I only learned about in Axios this morning and was barely acknowledged in the New York Times.
What's the question?
Well, the question is, so one of the things is you're talking about the events that we're doing, but I think the issue, what this listener is blaming it on, is poor press coverage. So even if there was increased press coverage,
it's not going to stop Donald Trump. We're worried about whether or not Donald Trump listens to court actions. I don't think more press coverage is going to chasing him.
And what Mary is saying is that this is the reason for the poor poll numbers that the Democrats are seeing in when it comes to the satisfaction with what the Democrats are up to. All right, let's move on. We go to Jeff. I doubt Trump is terribly worried about the dismal polling. He's getting outrageously rich every day, richer than he ever was in real estate and television. With his various patronage schemes, including the veritably untraceable income source that is his crypto meme coin scheme, Truth Social stock, and general stock market manipulation. Not to mention the individual deals surrounding his on-again, off-again tariffs that put money into his individual pocket. He is making it hand over fist. As always, he lets slip the truth in casual remarks like, America's getting richer than ever before. He means, of course, himself. That from Jeff.
Can I just say something? I want to go back to that prior thing about the sit-in on the steps, which I understand what they were trying to do, but I can't help but think about, no, it didn't get much press coverage, because I can't help but think about, like, the Target boycott, right? The boycott that's going against Target, and how the individuals that started that, they went out, they galvanized people, they're like, this is what we're doing, this is why we're doing it, and then you do it. Right. That and you have people join you and it's a big movement. I mean, it took a while for anyone to even figure out what was going on with the sit-in. Like, so what's the purpose? Why are they doing it? I think, and that's what's so frustrating about our Democratic leadership is, you know, you have to have a purpose behind it and you have to have a plan. All the civil rights movements, everything that happened, there was a plan behind it and it was a way executed that make it effective. And I'm just watching something like that. I'm just like, whoa, what's going on? And it just really left me disheartened a little bit.
Yeah, I think the Target one's a good point. Whether you agree with it, disagree with it or not, they had specific asks.
Mm-hmm.
They applied pressure against those who had the ability to deliver those asks. They've now been in negotiations. They got one of the four, and they said no, and they're going to continue. That type of collective action matters. Now, I don't know how you mount that against the government, but I do think that's a good case of when, and maybe in my lead up as to what the resistance looks like, I should have not only included the agencies not directly under administrative control, but also the social institutions and the businesses, including the law firms. I think those are places where pressure needs to be applied, because I can guarantee you, in the case of the law firms, you know, I've heard stories that I believe are pretty credible, that when Trump said, I'm going to take away your clearance and ability to work on governmental affairs, large clients who relied on these firms for for instance, Representation for Defense Contractors and the like, said, well, if you lose it, we have to go. We have no choice. I mean, so Trump applied that pressure effectively. And if you can and want to counter that pressure, doing so in an organized fashion, as they've done against targets, the right way to go. Sitting on the Capitol steps, not quite sure that gets you there.
Can I just also mention something else that's in that letter about the crypto coin?
Yes.
And no, number one, just imagine if Joe Biden had done this, basically saying it's the equivalent of a Swiss bank account. And for people who put money into this Swiss bank account are highly likely to be able to get favors from the White House. And so I think one other area that I hope is happening and I hope will produce some results is very serious investigative reporting that one way or another digs into who actually is putting money into this coin and then matches it up to what favors they've gotten. All information ultimately can be found, and I'm sure that at some point it will be found. That is just an absolutely outrageous example of profound corruption, as the letter writer was rightly saying.
So, but then who regulates it? Who changes it and brings them?
Well,
I
think it's just sunshine, just revealing it. What is happening right now? It's all secret, and so the president of the United States has a secret account that people can put money into. And that's this coin.
Not only that, by the way, but he then changed the rules and made secretive accounts easier to hold and have and less regulated.
That too.
I mean, so
that
there's
too,
two.
Yes.
So even you're making specific allegations, which many will suspect are true, but you don't even need to go that far to see what's inappropriate about what's happening. And I think the problem is, right, that the Supreme Court had 4 years to deal with the Emoluments Clause and somehow figured to kick that can down the road until Donald Trump wasn't president anymore.
Yeah, I don't think we can rely on the courts or the government to do this. I think it has to be dragged into the noonday sun and revealed.
And I do think it will help because I think the ties between Musk and the administration are partially why the administration is viewed so dimly in the polls that we see.
Dragged into the noonday sun. Well,
exactly.
we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue much more to talk about on this Monday morning. We'll pause. News with Ray Graff is next. Well, how are you this morning? Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have Jim Ketterer with us, senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna. And investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman, all joining us to share their thoughts on the news of the day. And we welcome you to do the same. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I do want to get to a few more letters and then we'll move on to other topics. We'll go
Joe, can I just jump in and
you
say...
You sure can.
The music that we just heard coming in, one of the great pieces of music produced by Booker T and the MGs,
yes.
Green Onions, that's just like... That gives me hope about the greatness of America and the things that we should value and support. And so I'm so glad to hear it this morning.
Good
after
stuff.
The death and carnage and all of that.
That we were discussing.
Yes.
You didn't miss
Not
anything.
Not in the studio, no.
Yeah, you didn't miss anything if you missed the first hour. I will say that you can see the playlist online, wamc.org/roundtable. By the way, just real quickly, speaking of just great music, I have not had a chance to. We thanked her while she was here, but Friday at 11 o'clock, we had Kate Pearson for the full hour from the B-52s
yeah.
in the studio
oh,
talking
wow.
to us.
I saw it.
And it was one of the most incredible experiences. It was just so much fun. We had a great conversation. She was an absolute delight. Such a wonderful supporter of the station, has been there for so long for us. And it was just a lovely, lovely moment. If you haven't heard it, it's almost an hour where we talk about her incredible career of starting out in Athens, Georgia, with the B-52s in Athens at the time of, as REM is starting to climb as well, and moving into college radio, and then, you know, now still 50 years later with a residency in Las Vegas. It's a really fascinating story, and she has her own solo album, Radios and Rainbows, that's out, and she's going to be at the City Winery on May 2nd. So really cool stuff, and I just wanted to, I know she's listening, so I just wanted to thank her so much for coming up and coming in studio and talking to us. It was an absolute delight. I heard a lot about it over the weekend, and it was just really special.
Can I mention a really cool B-52 story?
Yes.
I was at a benefit, and Fred, is it Schneider, who's from the B-52s, was there. And there was a good cover band, and at one point, their set obviously normally included Rock Lobster. And they invited Fred to come up on stage, but he wanted none of it. He wanted to hear them, and he wanted to dance. It was the most delightful thing I've seen.
Yeah.
It was just so authentic on his part, his enjoyment of his own music done by somebody else. It was amazing to see.
That's very, very cool. Yeah, it was a lot of fun, and I commented as we were walking out of the studio, I was like, oh, you don't always have to be depressed when you're on the air. It was a wonderful moment, and I just wanted to thank Kate Pearson very much for being with us on Friday. It was a very special moment. All right, let's go to these letters. Members of your panel have used the term resistance this morning on multiple occasions. The issue I see with too much of the Democratic leadership right now is that they're still behaving like an opposition party planning for the next election cycle. To be inspired, we need leaders that see the moment for the seriousness it brings and be willing to be more subversive. Fascism requires a different kind of fight than policies we just simply disagree with.
I think I was saying that, and I would have the listener go check out what Senator Chris Murphy is talking about, the senator from Connecticut. I think Jake Auchincloss, a member of the House from outside of Boston, and there are others and others. So I do think that this is happening.
We go to Paul. Attacking Dems for failing to act or provide the answer to the current disaster is completely missing the point. The Democrats, since at least 2010, have provided reasonably consistent governance that, for the most part, have expanded the economy, freedom, and promoted international alliances. Voters have missed this reality for many reasons and believed their lives were not living up to some imaginary utopia. Hence, Trump, the Democrats must stay the course. But I would argue, if you can't win under those circumstances, then when can you?
You mean under these circumstances? Currently?
The election.
The last election.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You have to win to.
Well, but wait. I mean, it goes back to the affordability crisis that the Democrats never had a reasonable answer for. Immigration was partially tucked underneath that, and then there was the sort of social disconnect that much of America felt from what they believed was the cause that the causes that the Democrats supported. So I'm still not surprised the Democrats lost.
Well, I mean, the point of the letter is the Democrats are not responsible; voters are responsible, and I would argue my point, perhaps badly communicated, was that that they are responsible if they did not get their message through, given the extreme circumstances that we were and are under at this time.
Yeah, Donald Trump, the tail risk fear about Donald Trump, and The Economist mentioned this explicitly in their endorsement of Kamala Harris, the tail risk fears have come true. We're way down that tail on a normal distribution of what happens in this democracy. But I hearken back to the Washington Post, who talked to a voter who said, look, I know who Donald Trump is. I know all the evil things he does and says, but I got to put my kid's going to college and I need money. And Donald Trump duped, you know, the center of America into thinking he was going to reduce costs on day one. And here we are.
Sean writes, the protests matter, the AOC and Bernie rallies matter, Harvard refusing matters. It all matters. It shows others they're not alone. It gives people the courage to speak up when they haven't before. It boosts morale amongst those standing up or afraid to stand up. Also, we see this administration repeatedly back down when challenged. Pushback works. If that's all we have until the midterms, then let's do it. And what's the alternative? Sit in the dark in fear and let Trump take our country away? No, thank you. Sean.
Yeah, I think there's a cumulative effect to these things. And as we were talking about the various different centers within civil society that I think the letter writer talks about. So it's not just governmental leaders, but people feeling empowered to get out in themselves, but also be part of civil society organizations that are going to push back on some of these, if not all of these policies. Yeah, I agree with that letter.
Martha says, so if we totally let the Republicans off the hook, do we not question, hold accountable, go after the Republicans who are the grand enablers in the enterprise? The best, the most courageous amongst them is, say, amongst them is, I'm scared of him. Is there no way for the populace to lean into them? Then we go to Nathan. Mark, we are so lucky to have conservative viewpoints on this program. I'm interested to hear if you are bothered by this administration's actions, if you think Trump's team are taking dangerous steps towards authoritarianism in our country. In your opinion, what should be done? It sounds like you're saying we can only wait until the next elections.
Oh, no, I appreciate the chance for clarification. First of all, I used to consider myself a centrist, and then I walked into this studio.
All I can say is fair.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
My point was, when we talk about what needs to be done, we were talking about Democrats. And I took that in the context of what legislators could do in the meantime. The answer is very little. I think, but I mentioned the sort of resistance within the government, government departments. I mentioned the Fed is one, and I think Jim rightly mentioned the other places we've seen that resistance, whether it be law firms or universities. And there are better or worse answers to what Trump is doing, and we've seen them. And I also think, from three branches of the government, I think the courts are the main place we're going to see the action. So. I am deeply troubled. I find what the administration is doing at best stomach churning. I do think there are important points of resistance, but I don't think that finding the Democratic Messiah is going to help us legislatively at this point. And I don't think it helps efforts, the other efforts we've talked about more broadly, all that much.
I also want to just say that if someone, I'm not sure if this letter writer is doing that, is trying to figure out me or any of us are where we stand politically, they might well be surprised. I think that criticism of the current Trump administration is not necessarily reserved to people who are liberal or progressive. This is not an administration that I think by any standard definition is conservative. They are flouting the Constitution of the United States. They're flouting the laws that have been passed. They are undermining the kind of basic tenets of our foreign policy. They are, they're hollowing out our institutions. They are siding with the Russians. None of that is conservative. And so that it has been cast as conservative and that you are not conservative if you don't support this administration is just kind of pure sophistry. But it is not matching up to what really conservatism is.
Great point. Go to Kevin. I agree with Mr. Ketterer that we will not be operating in a normal process towards 2026. And keeping warmongering at Pete Hegseth in office guarantees a future military enforcement of Trump's third and forever term. We go to Dan. I'm getting exactly what I voted for in Donald Trump. Fighting to end wars, bring home manufacturing, mass deportations. Only thing I don't like is that Israel still has an iron grip on Washington. a left-leaning organization like the Washington Post is obviously going to create polls showing failing approval ratings.
Oh, I just first of all, Donald Trump promised he would not curb inflation, bring down costs on day one. Inflation he has by virtue of the nonsense around tariffs. And it's really the nonsense more than it is the tariffs at this point, or maybe it's equally both. He's reignited inflation. As to ending wars, he's done exactly none of that so far, although he did promise you he'd be done with the Ukraine war on day one. So he's late. On that, and I don't think there's any prospect that we're getting any closer to any of those quote-unquote wars being ended. When, by the way, when you say end wars, I assume you mean in some sort of a just way, because as Ronald Reagan famously said, you can always end a war by surrendering. But that's probably not what we want democracies around the world to do. So, and when you talk about deportation, there is certainly a theater of the cruel that is there for you to consume. But in terms of the real numbers of deportations, they are not up dramatically since the Biden administration. Now, there are some nuances to that we could discuss, but the headline figure stands. So I got bad news for you. You got duped. And if you're still duped, that's really your fault.
And in terms of ending wars, too, we are engaged in military conflict in Yemen, and we have had no articulation of a policy to the American people, no understanding of what we're doing, why we're doing it. I mean, the Biden administration also had started this, but the Trump administration is continuing it. And I agree with Mark, you know, to say we're going to end wars in a place like Ukraine, you know, ending it in a certain way will, in fact, lead to more conflict. If we end it in a way that, you know, gives a great benefit to the Russians for their aggression, that this will undoubtedly put us in greater danger of ensuing conflicts in Europe.
So Mark was just talking about deportation, and I would like to go to our next story and start off on that, this having to do with the deportation of children. Trump officials defend sending three U.S. citizen children to Honduras. This from the Washington Post. Tom Homan, President Donald Trump's border czar, insisted that the Trump administration did not deport American children to Honduras, arguing that the White House sent the children to the country because their mothers who were being deported wished to bring them. Early Friday, three U.S. citizen children from two families were removed from the United States with their mothers by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. One of them is a four-year-old with stage 4 cancer who was sent without medication or the ability to contact their doctors, that according to a lawyer for the child's family. The others, 2 and 7 years old. The children's situation have intensified concerns that the Trump administration is carrying out deportation in a way that violates the legal rights of both citizens and non-citizens. Speaking to CBS's Face the Nation, Homan said Sunday that he's not aware of any specifics in the case of the four-year-old with cancer, but he dismissed the use of the word deported to describe the removal of the American children from this country. What word is it then?
We use removal now. You no longer use deportation orders. We have removal orders now. So that's he was just being fast and loose. But the long and short of it is what's happening here is it's all about the transparency that's going on. And that's what's so scary. Go back to the fear we spoke about in the first hour. What usually happens is if a parent of a U.S. citizen is being removed from the country, then what should happen is, one, before the ICE officer executes that removal order, especially if this person is not a danger to society, which we know that this individual is not because they've been on supervision by ICE for a number of years, right? And the reason why they were on supervision was because they had this U.S. citizen child who was probably receiving some sort of care. And then they were probably allowed a stay of removal by ICE, which allows them to stay the removal while this individual remains in the country because they have this U.S. citizen child who's probably receiving medical care. And that's the humanitarian aspect of what immigration does and how ICE deals with this. And during that time, this individual is allowed to get a work permit. This individual is allowed to work to support their family, and they pay taxes. That's how that works. Now what we have is the ICE is executing these immigration orders, and they're picking up individuals, and they're saying, this U.S. citizen child should never have been detained. That's our concern, right? This U.S. citizen child, what should have happened is that mother should have had a choice. One, what we ideally would have happened is they would have let her choose when she could leave. They could buy their own plane ticket and leave with their child. They have that option. The other thing is you have the option to release your, you know, give custody or guardianship of your child to someone else who could take care of that child and get that child to someone abroad, to the place where you are abroad. So that's what we're really like counseling our clients on right now is how we're going to deal with your U.S. citizen children if something happens to you. The scary part of this story for us is that the mother and the children were kept together in this detention facility. U.S. citizens are not under the jurisdiction of the Department of Homeland Security. U.S. citizens should not be in a Department of Homeland Security facility. If a U.S. citizen breaks the law, they are under the Department of Justice, FBI, so on and so forth. So that's why I always tell individuals, that's what the problem is transparency. They should not have been detaining them. They should have dealt with them, whether that is calling CPS to come get the U.S. citizen children, whether allowing the mother to call someone else to take guardianship of those children. But the Department of Homeland Security does not have jurisdiction, for the most part, over U.S. citizens.
Can I ask a question? And I don't know how relevant it is, but I mean, it seems obviously relevant to the well-being of this child. But the cancer diagnosis, how does that play in, and how often does the illness and health of one who is removed enter into the equation?
All the time. It's the number one question I ask an individual who has a removal order. Do you have any medical conditions? Because then that means that we have to take that in consideration when we interact with ICE, whether we're getting a stay of removal, whether we're getting accommodations. You know, there's all kinds of things they could have done. I believe they could have put on ankle support. I think they already were. You know, ankle supervision, I should say. So there's all sorts of options for them to deal with these individuals with U.S. citizen children.
Ankle supervision for a four-year-old?
No, ankle supervision for the mother to allow her to go home to be
Sorry.
With the child who's under care.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think that's the problem. And not only that is that because it's federal, they pick these individuals up and then they move them all over the country. And it's hard for us to track them
it seems to me that in this case and in other cases, there's a focus now on doing these things very quickly.
Yes.
Not transparently, as
exactly.
you said, and not following any kind of process that is in any way legal. So, you know, I also think about there's many cases now, but I think about the case of the Turkish PhD student who was going to Tufts and was pulled off the street and, you know, was here legally on a student visa. And she co-authored an op-ed that they said, I guess, you know, somehow undermines U.S. foreign policy. And they took her off the street and she was basically disappeared into the system for quite some time. And, you know, it seems that this is maybe circling back to what that previous letter writer said, you know, when they were voting for this, it's not just voting for fixing the immigration system. It's not just voting for getting people out of the country who shouldn't be here. But the sad reality is that many people voted for doing it in a way that is cruel, doing it in a way that is a spectacle of lawlessness and somehow, you know, brings down an iron fist. And not only is that unconstitutional and illegal, is that really the kind of country that we want to have?
And you can tell that it feels like that's the intent and purpose, because what we're seeing is that the immigration during the first administration, we saw more hiring of immigration judges, right? So you can put more people into the system. They can go through their due process. And if they're removed, they're removed. What we're seeing now is we're seeing immigration judges, Board of Immigration Appeals, all of them are being laid off. We don't have as many people. So what does that mean? There's no intent to use the system. Because otherwise, it would just be a backlog, and these individuals would not go anywhere. They would not be removed from the country.
Mark?
Well, it's clear the administration has basically quotas they've set for themselves. Initially, they were trying to publish 1,000 deportations a day when they couldn't get there because Biden and then Trump have been relatively successful at closing the border by removing some of the protections around asylum.
Mm-hmm.
So there aren't as many people to catch. So now they've taken those numbers down now. They no longer report them publicly, as I understand it. I would be so curious to know if you could trace the U.S. citizens that were caught up and find out if they ended up on the register, because those sort of ground level troops, if you will, are trying to find every live body they can to try and get those numbers up. I'm not going to say anything else because I think my other panelists have covered it, but I also just think of the arc of history. This period in the United States, we collectively, and I got bad news, historians are going to blame all of us for it. We're going to look stupid. You know how I know we're going to look stupid? Think about China and the one-child policy. All of the grief that was caused within that nation in order to control demographics, only to find out a few decades later, whoops, we overdid it. Now we need to fix our demographic problem. The good news is immigration for the United States is or could be and will again be a superpower for us. We will look at this period and historians will look at us and just look at us as a bunch of fools for what we did during this time frame.
I will say that, you know, what we're seeing is we are losing some of our individual researchers who would usually come to the U.S. They don't want to come to here anymore, and they're not choosing the U.S. any longer. And we are going to see diminishing individuals in our think tank, which is our superpower.
You know, I used to oversee a program in Egypt, a State Department program to recruit, in this case, Egyptians to come to U.S. universities. But this is a program, it's a worldwide program called Education USA. And so I had my finger on the pulse of that, and I'll tell more about it after the break.
Excellent. Thank you very much. We have much more to discuss. We will do exactly that. We welcome you. Last call for letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we will continue our conversation after this news update from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We have about 10 minutes left with this great group, and a couple of things that we wanted to do before we go into another topic.
Yeah, I just wanted to finish that thought of that Sienna was talking about international students and the effect on this. You know, the Institute for International Education estimated that in the last accounting of it, I think it was in 2023, their numbers, international students contribute about $50 billion a year to the American economy, not just paying tuition, because many of them come as full payers. That means that they can subsidize American students who need a scholarship, but also the multiplier effect of all that they spend in the economy and the value that they have that's beyond the finances, that our universities have been this great kind of magnetizing effect for international students. And I can tell you, I'm hearing from many people around the world who are now thinking they will absolutely not send their kids to go to college in the U.S., that they'll choose some other place or they'll have them stay at home. And I think we're going to see those numbers go down dramatically. The international students who are already here are very afraid that they can be ripped off the street for no reason whatsoever. And that's going to have a huge chilling effect and a huge effect on our institutions.
I mean, they're afraid that they're going to get their visas revoked for just being
right,
getting a traffic ticket, any law enforcement interaction.
Or writing an op-ed.
You know,
or
it can be anything.
Being next to a protest or anything or nothing.
We started this program by talking about our weekends and what we did. Hannah Dugan had a hell of a weekend. Officers handcuffed the Milwaukee County judge in public. Attorney General Pam Bondi bragged on Fox News about the administration's willingness to go after judges who, quote, think they're above the law. FBI Director Kash Patel began the day by announcing Dugan's arrest on social media and ended it by posting a photo of agents leading her away. While many Republican supporters of the president cheered the aggressive actions, critics of the administration said the spectacle sent a chilling message. I have to say, when I first read this story on Friday afternoon, I was like, oh, I'm sorry, what?
I said, what happened?
Yeah, I was like, what? That seems like a big deal.
It was a big deal. So what was happening is there were there was someone there who had an expedited removal order already, right? He had an expedited removal order. Once again, you got to see the pattern. They're going after individuals who already have removal orders. And he had, they found out he was there because obviously he committed a misdemeanor and his biometrics showed up probably in the FBI system. It triggered ICE and they knew he was going to be there for court. He hasn't been charged with any, he hasn't been convicted. That's what I wanted to say. So he was there with his attorney. ICE was outside. And this was really a constitutional issue at first, because when they came in to speak to the security, and figure things out, they said, do you have a judicial warrant? And they said, no, we have an administrative warrant. And that was the conversation that they were having with the clerk, right? They were in the public hallway of the court. So the first question is, can they be in the public hallway? You know, that's a conversation. And then it was, we have an administrative warrant. We need a judicial warrant for you to come in here. And that was the conversation that they were having between the clerk, at which point my understanding is the judge allowed the individual to go out another door, and then ICE ended up detaining that individual outside. So I don't think much of this would have happened if they would have stayed outside the courts, the courthouse, I should say, right? If they would have waited for them to come out the courthouse and arrested them at that time, it wouldn't have happened. But that's the issue at hand, is that the judge allowing the individual to go out a different doorway through the jury exit, does that make this was that obstruction? And that's the long and short of it.
Can I? Oh, I'm just going to ask a question because I'm really confused.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I don't think it's your fault in the press coverage. So if it was one type of warrant versus another,
no. So let's.
Does that matter
It was a warrant discussion. You know, you need a warrant in order to enter a Fourth Amendment protected area, right?
A courthouse in this case.
No. Well, a courthouse, and it's a constitutional question, whether or not the courthouse public hallways, whether that's protected. Is it public, private? That's a conversation to have, right? I would argue that it's public. Anyone from the public can come in.
Right.
So I should be able to come in. But that's the conversation that the clerk and the judge were having, was like, oh, you only have an administrative warrant to arrest them. You don't have a judicial warrant to arrest them. And they were having a legal argument about that. I think they had a right, in my opinion, they probably had a right to be in the public hallways of the courthouse.
The people
ICE
who
were officers.
ICE officers.
The ICE officers, yes.
Okay, but then if the judge knew they were trying to detain this individual, there are two ways this worked. One was she said, I don't want a commotion, go out this door. The other one was say, I don't want you detained, go out this
door.
And
that's the question, whether it's obstruction or not.
If she said, I don't want you detained, go out this door, she may have broken the law?
She may have been obstructing, right? If she was trying to obstruct them and they had a right to be in that public hallway. Okay. But if she was saying, this is causing too much commotion, just go out the jury and they can deal with you when you get outside. That's a different conversation in my head.
Is it common for ICE agents to show up in a courthouse?
Depends on the state. but for the most part, traditionally, there was a memorandum where ICE officers would not go into the courthouse, right? But they do come in for dangerous individuals. It's always been the case. If someone someone's a dangerous society and you're changing possession from local enforcement to federal enforcement, you go into the courthouse to get that individual.
So ICE wasn't acting in a way that was unusual in this case?
No. We've seen this many times. We tell everyone that if you get arrested, ICE may come to the courthouse and they may arrest you. That's quite common.
Was the judge behaving in a way that's unusual?
Oh, you're really hammering down here. Yeah. It depends on what her intent was.
Mm, which we don't know.
Which we don't know,
right.
I would say. Because non-public people do go out, jury members do go out that door, right?
Jury members
go out that door. But I don't know what her intent was.
But regardless, it doesn't, I mean, putting the video up of the perp walk and all of that, or not the perp walk, but, you know, the walk. Well, it was. That's what it was, right?
Yeah. I mean, and that's for the court to decide, right? What was the intent? What happened? I just read the affidavit of the ICE, you know, ICE agent.
No, but Joe's making the point, even if there's a legitimate question as to whether or not this judge broke the law, it's one thing, and I think the article we read highlighted this. Donald Trump, when he was alleged to have broken the law, he was asked to present himself.
No, he was convicted of breaking the law.
Well, okay. But initially, he was asked to present himself at the courthouse. They didn't go to Mar-a-Lago and perp walk him out and post
exactly,
it on social
exactly,
media. So the
exactly.
question here is, is, A, did she break the law? And B, even if you believe that she did, how do you interpret the public, the public publicity of them arresting her? And is that just part of the Trump administration's attempts to chill the response of the judiciary?
It's a message being sent.
Well, that's exactly what's happening, because what we've been saying to individuals, because everyone's been asking this question, is what are our rights? What should we do? Are they allowed to come in? What's our Fourth Amendment rights? What do they need in order to enter? Everyone says a warrant. You need a warrant signed by a judge. You need a federal warrant. Not a federal. You need a judicial warrant signed by a judge in order to enter a private space. Right. And so I think that's what everything's been happening. But now what you might hear is individuals that may have been asked for that warrant beforehand and say, hey, do you have a warrant before you coming in? If they see a judge getting arrested and a judge asks similar questions, then they may not be willing to ask that question because they don't want to be charged with obstruction and have to defend themselves, even if they're right at the end of the day.
A lot of land plowed this morning. We got a lot of good stuff to talk about, and my thanks to all of you for your input and for sharing your thoughts with us. Mark Whitman, Jim Ketterer, and Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, thank you so much. I so appreciate it. A reminder, you can be a part of our Wednesday program at Oneonta when we talk to students at Hartwick College. We would love to have you there. It's the 100th day of the Trump administration. We'll be talking about that, amongst other things. Just go to WAMC.org, WAMC.org, and there is a link there, and you can find out. Tickets are $50, and we would love to have you be a part of the program. Stay tuned. More Roundtable coming up.